Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Welcome and thank you for joining us today. This is an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we think and believe as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner Ravinder awaits you there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat. So, Ravinder, time for your opening lines. Say hello to everyone and spread your joy of the day.
Well, hello, everyone. And it is a wonderful, wonderful day today. But then we've just had a few days in Zion, and that just refreshes the soul. Do come join me in the chat room and I'll share some of the details with you. It's eldontaylor.com/chat.
Every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week I was traveling and as such we aired a replay. 2 weeks ago our guest was Dr. James Stein and we discussed his book, The Paranormal Equation. Jackie wrote, "Wow, what a guest. Who would expect a mathematics professor on Hay House Radio? And who would think they would be interesting to listen to? I wish my math instructors in school were as enlightening." Richard opined, "I am thankful for today's show. I'm always attempting to judge if what I'm sticking in my head is true or hoo-hoo. I think James D. Stein contributed greatly in that quest. I'm looking forward to getting the paranormal equation and the right decision." Gwyneth wrote, "Thanks for the show today. It's always a good time." Mod Girl commented, "Missed some of the show. We'll listen again in archives. Can't wait until Dr. Stein comes back. He's the perfect guest. You'd want to have him around at a party because he has such fascinating things to offer. Very engaging." Moving on, Jane wrote, "I love Eldon. He's honest and very interesting." Now, I like that one. Ravinder, what do you think of that?
I like you, too.
Cute. Livia wrote, "I listen to your show on Hay House and love it." Dave wrote, "I have bought three of your books. They are great." Teresa wrote, "Thanks for the freebies. I recently was laid off from my job and my mom died, so I really listened to your work." We're very sorry about that, Teresa. For all of you out there, remember, Teresa is speaking about the free InterTalk programs that we offer on my site as just a part of our own Pay It Forward program. Check it out by going to InterTalk, InnerTalk.com. Jessica wrote, "I've really enjoyed reading your book, Mind Programming, and I use your CDs daily in my office. They are helping." Emery wrote, "I used the InterTalk program, especially for victims of abuse, and had great success. Now, as a therapist, I have a client that needs the same messages." Charles wrote, "Mr. Taylor and his products changed my life." Lawrence wrote, "My wife and I have been listening to several of your InterTalk CDs. They have really helped with our relationship and my anxiety. Thank you." Martin wrote, "Many thanks to Dr. Taylor and his wonderful work. His CDs are godsend for me." Gene wrote, "I use your Forgiving and Letting Go CD while performing Reiki. It works wonders because forgiving and letting go are so beneficial to the healing process. Thank you so much." Well, you're so very right, Gene. It all begins with forgiveness. Now, for all of you out there, remember the forgiving program Gene's speaking about is free as a downloadable. The CD's free, too, but there's a shipping charge if you order it. Just go to InterTalk, InnerTalk.com, and choose free programs from the left-hand navigation pane. Couldn't be a lot easier. All right, that's all the time we're going to take for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming, and once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show, codependence. What is codependence? Is it codependent to expect your children to respect you? How about return your efforts by doing small things for you? I mean, if mom says something like, "If you loved me, you'd do X or Y," is that codependent? Is it codependent behavior to expect your spouse to treat you in certain ways? After all, look at all you do for them. I mean, if they loved you, wouldn't they want to please you? Exactly what and how does codependent behavior become a part of addiction behavior? Or does it? Is it evidence of codependence if you remain with someone who abuses you, verbally, physically, or emotionally? If so, when do you quit? And when do you try one more time? I mean, remember that old statement, don't give up 1 minute or one last try before the miracle? Well, our guest today can answer this and many more questions about codependence because she literally wrote the book on it. Indeed, over 20 years ago, I was in the United Kingdom lecturing, and I met my lovely bride, Ravinder. We chatted one evening in Chester over dinner, and to my surprise, the idea of codependence had not yet arrived in England. Now, here I was lecturing to a student body studying psychotherapy and hypnotherapy, and they were ignorant of codependence. The subject had become so important in conversations about mental health and well-being in America that I was genuinely taken back. No one knew of our guest or her work, but that was then, and it's quite different now. Our guest today likely needs no introduction, but just in case, let me tell you a little about her. Melody Beatty is one of America's most beloved self-help authors and a household name in addiction and recovery circles. Her international best-selling book, Codependent No More, introduced the world to the term codependency in 1986. Millions of readers have trusted Melody's words of wisdom and guidance because she knows firsthand what they're going through. In her lifetime, she has survived abandonment, kidnapping, sexual abuse, drug and alcohol addiction, divorce, and the death of a child. Following the success of Codependent No More, Melody authored other books, including Beyond Codependency and The Language of Letting Go. Her most recent book is Make Miracles in 40 Days, Turning What You Have into What You Want. An article in Psychology Today by Seth Meyers and Katie Gilbert had this to say about Melody, quote, "She developed the concept of codependence as illustrated in her self-help juggernaut, Codependent No More. The concept, embraced by the mainstream to the point of water cooler ubiquity, is one of the most important concepts to have emerged from psychological thought in the past 50 years. Close quote. Melody Beatty's 24-year writing career has produced 15 books published in 20 languages and hundreds of newspapers and magazine articles. She has been a frequent guest on many national television shows, including, of course, Oprah. She and her books continue to be featured regularly in national publications, including Time, People, and most major periodicals around the world. So let's just get this wonderful woman in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Melody Beatty.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me. I was just wrapping up a conversation with my daughter, and she was so thrilled that I was going to be on anything to do with Louise Hay, because she adores Louise Hay.
Well, that's just wonderful. That's fantastic. I mean, we all do here, too, as well.
Louise Hay is fantastic to her. It's interesting how those things go. And I was listening to your introductions, and it sounds like you're doing great work. And I think one of the hardest things there is to do, it's not to put out a self-help book. It's to help people change the way they think. That's the challenge.
How very, very true. Well, it's truly an honor to have you join us. That's a fact. Maybe you and Louise Hay, I'd have stand side by side because you are both icons to me. I read your book in 1986 when it first came out, and I think I started touting your work way back then. So, but integral to what it is that you do is your personal life. I mean, it has so much to do with what you've learned and how you teach today. And so I'm obligated to ask you first thing out of the chute, share your story as it led up to your insights regarding codependence. I mean, I understand you were an alcoholic at the age of 12.
Right. I had started drinking when I was 11. I was an alcoholic with blackouts by the time I was 12. When I turned 18, I still was a straight-A student at a very private, strict academy, and got my straight A's, graduated on the Twin Cities Honor Roll, And I had one goal, and that was to become a drug addict. I had decided that alcohol was killing me, and my mom had always blamed the family problems on my dad's drinking. So I thought, well, I'll change that. I'll become an addict. And so I did. When I reached that goal, and it was very clear to me the day I reached that goal, it was like I began this journey to recovery, and I wanted to work helping other people recover from drug addiction. And after 2 years of sobriety and going to college, I showed up at a treatment center, and they said I was going to work with the families of the addicts. And I said, what are you talking about? I'm new here. I don't know what to do with them. They said, that's why you get the job. We don't know what to do with them either. And that was at a time when treatment was first beginning. Unbeknownst to many people, treatment did not always exist. There was a time when addicts were sent to a federal farm just long enough to dry out before they got put back on the streets, or they were put on the methadone program. But treatment did not exist as we know it now. And codependency particularly did not exist. Our thinking was that you controlled everything around you. That was the way to handle things, control. And as we all know, it usually doesn't work.
No.
It doesn't work well. And I wish, and I've always wished, I could give people a list of rules for what codependency is and what it isn't. And it's just not that easy. Because so many things that are labeled codependency are very normal reactions to life. It's normal to freak out when you discover your daughter is using crack. It's normal to freak out when you discover you've married an alcoholic, and to try and make that go away. And the longer I look at codependency, and having gone through the death of my son, I begin to think that grief, unresolved grief and trauma, have more to do with both codependency and addiction than probably anything else.
Well, let's while you're there, you know, let's pursue that notion for a minute before we get deep into codependence per se.
Okay.
Because quoting from your website, quote, although it almost destroyed her when her 12-year-old son Shane died in a ski accident in 1991, eventually Melody picked up the pieces of her life again. I wanted to die, but I kept waking up alive, she says. She began skydiving, mountain climbing, and teaching others what she'd learned about grief, close quote. So please share with us what you did learn about grief. And if you would, you know, the psychologist in me is forced to ask you whether or not you think Thanatos urge had anything to do with you taking up so many dangerous activities like skydiving.
No, what happened to me was that by the time I got through my grief from losing my son, it was time for my daughter to move on, and I was in the empty nest syndrome. And ever since I had recovered, I had children, I had a family. Now that I had gotten, you never get over the loss of a loved one. You do, you learn how to live with it. It stops being overwhelming, but we don't do grief. Grief does us. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that can't be therapized away. It's how life heals our heart when we've taken the risk of loving deeply. So what I did is, instead of keeping my life as though I still had children living at home, I made a list of all the things I hadn't done but wanted to do so I could enjoy this next part of my life. So I made my list, and I started doing those things. Skydiving was one. Scared the bejesus out of me. But it also helped me realize how much I enjoyed life. And it was good, because fear has been a big part of my life, my whole life. I was abducted off the streets when I was age 4. When you live in a dysfunctional family, fear is a large part of daily life. And to have to walk to the door of a pl- the open door of a plane at 12,500 feet and then jump requires a lot of letting go and a lot of being afraid and doing something anyway. And so it was good for me. And I liked the time under canopy. That, to me, was a time when I could meditate at the threat of sounding too new agey, it was like meditating with the angels. I was up in the air, I was under canopy, and I could just meditate, close my eyes, and see how very beautiful this world is. The mountain climbing sounds more intriguing than it is. I did a lot of my mountain climbing in China and Tibet, and mountain climbing there involves walking up thousands and thousands and thousands of stairs till you get to the top and reach a temple. That was good for me. It was one of my best trips. There was two trips, three months in China and 1 month in Tibet going to Mount Kailash. And so it was more doing things I really wanted to do instead of sitting around and waiting for my old life to return.
It's wonderfully well put. Let's get to codependence. Typically, we think of codependent as one who loves an addict. Flesh this idea out for us, if you will, and further define codependence so that we get an idea of just exactly what's involved, because it does involve more than chemical addiction.
It is. We can be not involved with an addict or alcoholic and still demonstrate the behaviors we call codependent on a regular basis and on an unconscious basis. The problem, like I said, is many behaviors that we label codependent are normal behaviors and they're things everyone does. To me, it gets to a point of crossing a line. Are we stuck in a behavior? Are we doing it all the time, whether it's appropriate or not? And is it hurting us and the people we love? And that's a decision that we can each really only make for ourselves.
That's interesting, because there are some cultures that seem to promote what we would think of as codependence, such as those that enforce arranged marriages, place women in secondary categories to men, and so on. Do you see that as codependent, or do you see it as just culturally bound, and is there a difference?
Well, each culture has their own ways, their own traditions, their own customs, and I don't think it's for us to judge. I think it's a little bit arrogant of us to say, well, everyone should be just like us. Everyone should have rules and systems just like us. And I've also discovered it's impossible to change. I've spent a lot of time in Egypt getting to know families that live close to the pyramids and talking to the women there. And they were scared to death of going out on their own, of having a job, of even going downtown by themselves. They didn't want things to change because this is what they were comfortable with. This is what they knew. So to take a person and pluck them out of a system that's been a way of life, not just for them, but for their ancestors, and put them into a way of life we decide is best, it doesn't work. First of all, the person doesn't want it. And secondly, they're not ready.
That's interesting.
And so we each have to decide when we're doing things that hurt ourselves. On the other hand, there are cultures that absolutely promote codependency, that are built around the very tenets of it. And those are the countries that are... I have a belief in people, though, and I believe that people will find their way to personal freedom at their own rate, when it's time for them, and when the time is right, and that's something they need to decide.
See, I started to say, you know, that I find your comments about Egypt very interesting. One of the passions that we have in my own organization is the support for a group called Women for Women. And, you know, they specialize in areas like Afghanistan and Pakistan, where women, for all intent and purposes, are treated like chattel property. It may as well be a cow. They're bought and sold and, in fact, discarded to the stable if they fail to please their male master. And everything that I've seen about this group and about those people that that they work with is designed to empower women as opposed to, continue the direction of the culture. And it seems, based on everything I've read and everything they put out, that that's what women desire, that they're excited about their ability to go to college. But you find that different in Egypt.
Well, not different, but they have to discover this at their own rate and their own time and when they're ready. I mean, to take them out and pluck them. At the same time, there were women who were afraid to even go downtown on their own. One woman had just become a pilot in Egypt. So, you know, you have a range of people at different levels in different places in their growth. Have you visited Pakistan?
No, I have not personally.
I spent 2 weeks arguing with an embassy in Jordan and finally got them to allow me to get into Pakistan. And they allowed me to go into there for 10 days. And so I pounded around over there. And it was very interesting. And one of the things that I consistently heard from both the women and men is that the women have more power in the families than the men do. The men were the needy ones. The men needed to be in relationships, needed it desperately. It was very interesting. My travels through the Middle East really opened my eyes. I also found, you know, women taking off their veils and not wearing them when they were ready at their own time and speed in certain countries. Now, there were countries that I wasn't willing to go to. Afghanistan, no way. You're not going to get me into that country. I would inadvertently do something that would, you know, leave me without a limb at
right.
best. I couldn't get into either Iran or Iraq. I did try. I wasn't able to do that. But it was an interesting delve into cultures different than ours. But there's cultures like Mexico. I've worked with a lot of women from Mexico, and I've been down there and talked to them. And that culture tends to perpetuate codependency on a different level and in different ways. Oriental cultures tend to perpetuate codependency. It's part of their traditions, their lifestyles. And our country perpetuated it until the 80s.
Until your books.
Right, and it still surprises me when I find out that people have never heard of codependency. I have 3 websites that I have forums on, so I interact with my readers personally. I answer all the posts myself. And there are people every day in this country for the first time learning about codependency. There are 5 children in this country every day in the United States that die from child abuse. 4 of them are under the age of 5. So with all our information, all our education, all our awareness, there are still millions of people who haven't heard about any of it yet.
Great tragedy. Well, you've just explained something very important to me. My wife, her family is from the Punjabi area. And of course, when there was a separation, she ended up being born in New Delhi. And now after your entire explanation, I now understand this. That's why she's so much in charge of our household. We have a hard break coming up here in just a couple of seconds. Give your website real quickly that you would like our listeners to visit in order to reach out to you.
The best one is melodybeattie.net.
All right, melodybeattie.net. We're speaking with Melody Beattie about her wonderful work, beginning with her book, Codependent No More. If you're not already in our chat room, now is a great time to join in the conversation. We have a short film for you today that we'll show during the break that features our guests. So just go to eldontaylor.com, that's eldontaylor.com/chat. Be sure to stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after our break.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Melody Beatty about her work with codependence and grief. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies, and from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. Speaking of opinions, before the break, we were discussing cultures and codependent behavior in those cultures. And, of course, my lovely bride, Ravinder, who hosts our chat room, has some personal experience, having been born in New Delhi and raised by parents, as I mentioned before the break, who came from the Punjab area, Kashmir, before the break in or the division, I guess, as it's thought of, between Pakistan and India. And Ravinder, you were suggesting that you didn't think Melody Beatty had it quite right. I mean, that's a big shoe to wear, but I'm gonna let you go ahead and introduce your thoughts to Melody.
That is correct. You know, that is an area you and I have been talking about for the last 20-odd years, where Melody said that, you know, in Pakistan, you know, where the females are restricted in things that they can do, they have the power in the house. And that was when I jumped up, Melody, and was screaming over here saying, that's not true. The fact is, the females will say they have the power in the house because it helps them feel better about being controlled the way they are. And the men will say that the females have the control in the house because it makes it possible for them to keep doing the things that they do, to have the control. The fact is, you cannot have choice until you know what choice is.
That's interesting. Do you want to comment on that, Melody?
That choice. And if you're afraid to make that choice, and if fear is keeping you locked into the old ways, you're not ready to change yet. A whole system needs to change together. You can't pluck one person and change the entire system. It has to grow and change together.
That makes sense.
I think you have to experience it. You have to see it. It's impossible to make any choice of your own without you being aware that the choice even exists. I mean, I was always very aware. With the Indian culture, it's very, very different to, you know, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Although I was, you know, my family is from Punjab, so there are lots of cultural similarities there. But I always said as a child, you know, there are lots and lots of Indian households where everything appears to be totally equal, absolutely, 100%. But I say it appears that way because even as a child, I was very aware that the women have as much freedom as the men allow them to have, in which case they have none. So you have to fight against it. So no, I feel very deeply about all the females over in those areas, in Iran, in Iraq, you know, because to me they are sisters, they are mothers, they are daughters, they're my family, and they don't have a clue as to freedom is about.
Absolutely, the countries that did not allow me into those countries have problems that I wasn't willing to take on. I mean, I just wasn't willing to risk my life to go into those countries because I'm too used to having freedom to go in there and lose my limbs. I mean, even in Pakistan, it horrified me when I would be riding down the road and I would see people with limbs cut off, scurrying along the road, and they would have no legs left, so they would be using their arms to transport them. I mean, it was horrifying in many ways. I was in the third floor of a hotel room, and it was advertised as the best hotel in Pakistan because almost everything worked. And I was in a third floor balcony room, and a man scurried up the outside of the building and broke into my room. Even when he saw me, I started screaming. I had gone to bed and I was reading. And there, if you had enough money to take a taxi, you were looked upon as somebody that they could rob because you were rich. And so I played it very, very close to the belt there. And this man just kept coming into my room. I started screaming. He didn't back off. And so here I am, and they had armed guards out in the hallways. And I'm out in the hallway, buck naked in a Muslim country, screaming at the top of my lungs. And, I mean, they did find the man. They did catch him. But it is a different environment. What I'm saying is we can't go in there and superimpose our desires about what's right and expect those things to take place overnight. Because the women, it's the same thing we say here. People have to want the change. And until they want it, and until they have the courage to make these decisions, to get past their fear.
You know, that really brings us to, I think, a critical aspect of understanding exactly what empowers codependence. And you know, I think of it as the absence of self-love. You put a great deal of emphasis on self-love, whether it's love, it's respect. Indeed, you quote Shakespeare in chapter 11 of Codependent No More by stating, quote, "This above all else, to thine own self be true," which most of us has heard, but you go on. "And it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man." So if I imply from that correctly, what you're really saying is self-love is more than just I like myself, I'm a good person. It's about a level of honesty that few people dare to take. Have I got that right or not?
Absolutely. And in my latest book, I have written 18 books. I'm done writing books now. On my other list of things to do was to write screenplays and write for television, which I'm doing now.
Cool.
But being honest with ourselves is probably the most difficult thing in the world to do. And I heard during the break time somebody talking about our first thought in the morning is probably our most honest one, because we don't have time to get our whole system of denial and defenses up in order. And so my recommendation is that if it's possible, and it's not always possible, if you have a baby crying for a bottle, you have things to do, you have to get the kids out the door to school, you have to get ready for work, you can't always take that half an hour. But for those that can take half an hour and be absolutely honest with themselves by writing down everything. And it has to be kept very private, because a lot of times we're so ashamed of what we really think and how we really feel that we're not going to disclose this information to anyone.
You know, I love what you're saying, and I share that view completely. My background, of course, tends to be more left brain and science. And so when I read studies, and I just read one a month or so ago, that showed that being honest had a positive correlation with health and wellness, it further fortifies the notion that genuine self-love is about being honest, not about denying who you are in order to become some chameleon, put on some suit, some dress in a certain way, behave, or take on a certain body form, and so on and so forth. Now, that said, the flip side, it seems to me, has to do with forgiving, and in order to forgive, acceptance becomes a major aspect of how we deal with the various input in our lives. That's also an important element in your work, and I'd like for you to unpack those counterparts, forgiveness and
so
acceptance,
many areas
for us.
Tied in together. And I'm going to start by telling you something that I was told when I first got into the field of recovery 2 years after I got sober back in 1975. My brother-in-law told me, every revolution becomes an institution. And to my dismay, I've seen that happen in this country in recovery. I've seen treatment centers that were all about experimentation and trying new things and finding new ways to work become institutionalized and then become commercialized. And the thought of change just is more than they can handle. Now, a lot of that has to do with what Obama and other countries around the world declared finally that the war on drugs has been a multi-trillion dollar failure. It has not worked, and we need to do something different. Now I'm going to go back again. This is
I'm here. Do we lose Melody? Oh, she dropped. Are we still on the air? Okay, well, good. We've lost Melody. Obviously, if you're out there listening to us, wherever you are in the world, you're aware that we have a little bit of a technical hiccup at this moment. So, Ravinder, you had challenged Melody before we picked up on this latest conversation. Were you happy with what she had to say?
You know, I would still question. I mean, she's totally correct. You know, the people over there are not going to make a different choice until they get to see it, although that's not always the case. Remember that girl in Pakistan who was shot? She was 12, 13 years old.
I do.
Because she started talking about it. So there you come down to your absolute virtue idea, the idea of the absolute right and wrong. She hadn't experienced it, but in her heart of hearts, she always knew that women aren't supposed to be treated that way.
You know, one of the problems, and of course you and I discuss this all the time, is when you look at cultures around the world, you see that they're often, well, there is such a thing as cultural relativity, period, end of quotation. And so the value systems in each culture are set by that culture. And then we can look and we can often see that there are conflicts in these values from culture to culture to culture. So from our culture, when we see an atrocity of the kind you just described, or the one that stands out and that I've used so many times, it happened about a year ago, the young girl, 14 years of age, whose nose and ears are cut off and discarded to the stable because she failed to please her husband after her father sold her to this man. When you see those kinds of things in the world, I'm compelled to believe that they're wrong. Culturally relative or not, I'm compelled to believe that they're wrong. So then I search for, you know, an absolute value. And as we have discussed, the only thing that I've ever come close to with this absolute value is the idea there has to be. It's like the form and the Platonic cave, but the particular can be so evasive. I think we have Melody Beatty back. Do we have you back?
Right. Yes. The power went off in the house, so the phone went off.
I'm sorry. That's not a good deal. You got the power back that quickly, though.
Yeah, it went right back on.
Okay.
But what we do have happening, and I believe that we're all coming from the right place, but I'm not getting enough explanations in. First of all, I believe that we have atrocities that are unbelievable taking place right here in this country as well.
True.
The child they found out, it was 12 people knew this child was being treated like an animal, and he died. And that happened about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's unthinkable.
Unconscionable, that's right.
And people knew about it. You can't tell me that with a family of 12 that nobody knew what was going on. And yet nobody reported it. Nobody did anything. And so the biggest thing I found out through my travels was we have more in common with almost every country in the world than we'd like to admit. We just do a better job of hiding it, and we do have more awareness at times in our country, and at times we have less. But getting back to codependency and getting back to what causes the problem and how do we find solutions, I got to meet Elizabeth Kubler-Ross before she died.
Wonderful woman.
For those who haven't heard of her, she's known as the Death and Dying Lady. She came up with the five stages of grief and loss, and those are all also considered the five stages of forgiveness and acceptance.
Right.
Now, what if we added two more stages to that? One was obsession, and one was guilt. We would have codependency.
That's interesting.
And if you look at children that grow up in dysfunctional families or dysfunctional societies, dysfunctional anything, and we don't dare. A child does not dare think beyond their parents if they depend on their parents for survival. It's too frightening. Many times putting up with abuse, many times having low self-esteem is actually a form of survival. Because if we believe there is no control going on in this world, if there's no overall picture that's right, if things just happen at random, and if we can just be victims at random, that's too much for a young child to handle. It's much easier to say, there must be something wrong with me, because that is a form of taking control of our life when we don't have other information available to us.
Right. So what you're saying is to denial, anger, the notion of bargaining, depression, and acceptance, you would add two things. Again?
Guilt and obsession.
Guilt and obsession. Now, in doing that, describe a personality then who would be most inclined to be codependent. You began by they would have low self-esteem in all probability.
Right. They would have low self-esteem. They would be obsessed with the problem. They would talk about usually the other person over and over and over again. They would not be able to stop talking about it. And actually, obsession is not all bad, because by telling our story over and over and over, we ultimately can incorporate the unthinkable into our life story. And the minute we accept the truth, we come into balance. When we're in balance, we know what to do next. It's when we're in denial about who we are, how we feel, what we want, and I mean how we really feel about what's going on. When we're in denial about those things, we are instantly out of balance. We don't know who we are. And when I talk about self-love, I don't mean narcissism. I don't mean self-pampering. I mean accepting how we feel, who we are, what we think, what we want, everything that makes up us, and being honest about it. To me, that's what self-love is. And add to that being fully present for ourselves in each moment. That, to me, describes self-love.
And I love your description. But, currently our research shows us that about 90% of all of our choices are made in the unconscious. I mean, fMRI studies have very well validated that recently. What do you say to a person then habituated in any behavior about how they make new choices? I mean, you have a book titled Choices. So what is it a person must do to turn that corner, to change what's in that unconscious that, is really the deciding factor in their life?
Well, I was very hesitant to write a book about making miracles. But the miracle that can come from us taking a step forward to becoming conscious about who we are can truly make miracles in our lives. And again, we do that by spending, if it's even half an hour a day, with who we really are, how we really feel, what we really think, that level of awareness. And people can go to therapy. They can spend 2 hours a week in therapy for 10 years, or they can spend half an hour with who they really are every day, write it down. Some way of getting in touch with who we really are. And that, to me, is what worldwide is needed, because the minute people get honest with themselves and accept that and become aware of that, change will happen on its own. I am an absolute believer in the miracle of life, and that life will evolve on its own. We need to work with it. We can push it a little by spreading this awareness, but it's slow. It takes time, and we've got a lot of people fighting it.
I share that totally. You write in your book, you quote Robert Frost, who says, quote, "I'm not a teacher, I'm an awakener." Now, based on that quote, I assume that that's the reason you resist the role of teacher, or even as some would have it, including myself, I would put guru in front of you when it comes to this area of work.
No, I just don't want to accept that. You make a person a guru, then you find a fault in them, and you're going to kick them right off that platform.
Our heroes have clay feet. Okay.
Exactly. All right. The best I can do is do honest, hard research, not just for my own life, but from other people, from talking to other people, from observing other people, and then writing about it as honestly and forthrightly as I can in a way that makes sense to people.
All right, I've saved the most important question to last. There, throughout all your work, throughout your life, throughout, you know, what I would think of as your redemption, your salvation, you talk about the power of God, the power of the higher power. How important is that to self-love?
To me, it's crucial.
Come on, expand that.
It's the difference between the days when I take even 2 seconds and ask a higher power, as I understand God, for help, and the days that I don't. And it does make all the difference in the world. If I think there is no power greater than myself, I'm in trouble. I had no intention of ever getting straight. It was a spiritual awakening that got me sober. It was a spiritual awakening that made me aware of codependency. Every time I've moved forward, some people believe in God, and then other people know that there is a God. And they can use any word they want as a description of God. That doesn't matter to me. You know, it's like, I don't care where we live on the planet. At nighttime, when we see the moon, it's the same moon.
I totally concur. You know, and I think you said it best. We are lost when we think we're the most important thing. There is nothing greater or larger than us. In about 30 seconds, Melody Beatty, please. You have a wonderful book, Daily Meditations. You have a grief club. Share with our audience your 3 websites and how they can reach out and learn more about you, get your books.
Well, I'm going to change that a little bit and say, if there's one thing all your listeners could do to help themselves, it would be to go back and deal with all their unresolved grief. They don't have to wear black. They do need to understand all the grief and losses they're carrying, and that includes whatever country they're living in.
All right, we're out of time. We've come to the end of another hour. I want to thank the team at Hay House Radio for making what we do on this show so pleasurable, and of course, a big thank you to you and to our special guest today. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll join us again same time, same place next week. Until then, remember, believing in yourself always matters.